Due to a scheduling conflict, today's originally scheduled guest is not available. The following is an encore presentation of our Media Matters program originally broadcast on January 31st.
Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. This is Bob McChesney on WILL AM 580, coming to you today, January 31st, 2010. Our guest today is the very first guest we had on Media Matters when we first went on the air nearly 8 years ago. Janine Jackson from Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting will be joining us for the whole hour. So sit back, relax, and enjoy the show. But before we go to Janine Jackson, let's go to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
The Institute for Local Self-Reliance has issued a new report on public broadband networks. Christopher Mitchell, a researcher at the Minneapolis-based Institute for Local Self-Reliance, says that these public networks have proven themselves to be globally competitive, and they offer the single best hope for communities that need to stay competitive in the digital age. Mitchell gives the example of Lafayette, Louisiana, which has one of the best networks in North America.
You can get 100 megabits there at affordable rates. They actually have possibly the cheapest, lowest tier offering for high-speed connectivity, which is a 10-megabit connection, symmetrical, which is available at under $30 a month.
But national broadband policies are not helping communities retain power over their broadband networks, and some state legislatures have actually enacted laws against publicly owned networks.
So there's a variety of barriers that states have passed, largely at the behest of very powerful companies. Four states have made it pretty much impossible. That's Texas, Missouri, Nebraska, and Arkansas. And then there's a number of other states that have varying levels of difficulties.
But the private sector is not capable of bringing broadband to all of America, Mitchell says. And broadband is now a necessity for every community.
If we want to talk necessity, then it's absolutely imperative that we empower rural communities to build these faster networks because there's not enough profit in there to get enough private sector investment.
Public networks are also important for urban areas. Competition keeps prices down and investment high.
If we want competition in broadband, and that means competition in any sort of media delivery, really, then we need to look at public ownership because the private sector is not suited to delivering competition other than this duopoly, which I think most of us regard as very poor competition at best.
For more information, go to muninetworks.org.
At the Free Press Summit last week in Washington, D.C., multimedia journalist Farai Chidea, Frontline's David Fanning, and the BBC's John Tate discussed the possibilities for expanding and improving the U.S. public media system. Tate, the director of policy and strategy at the BBC, talked about the BBC's recent election coverage and the need for robust funding for such wide-ranging reporting.
Essentially, the breadth and depth of coverage by the BBC of the domestic election is seen as part of the lifeblood of democracy in Britain. I think commercial models would not support the breadth, the depth, the forensic fact-checking, the scrutiny level that we bring to bear on it. And we create a vibrant, I think, rich public space in the UK for people to reflect on politics and civil society in general without ads, with a high degree of scrutiny and accuracy, triple checking, all of that. But essentially, it's a social choice that be in place, really. It's quite a deep social choice for that to happen. And for all that you might talk about the mechanics of how it's funded, and that's very important, and we're very lucky. I think underlying it is a very profound question of civil society and public choice.
Calling the process of choosing stories to tell a complex piece of alchemy, David Fanning, who started Frontline at Boston's WGBH in 1983, lamented that there are so many stories to tell and there are so few hours to tell them. He believes that it's a wonderful time to be a journalist and is heartened by new technologies that allow journalism to thrive on a shoestring budget. But he's frustrated that resources aren't being used to their fullest capacity.
I think the system in large part is moribund. I think we don't begin to harness the kinds of capital we have, not necessarily in public television, but surrounding public television, in the communities and in the neighborhoods and in the educational institutions very often that house those public television stations. There is a lack of real enterprise in the system.
Chidea, a journalist, author, and longtime public radio contributor, cited the need for more diversity in the system.
In the U.S. last year, newsroom diversity in terms of hiring dropped in television, print, and radio, right, at the same time that American diversity is increasing. I think that's shameful and stupid, but, you know, it's one thing to say it's shameful and stupid. It's something else to do something about it.
Fanning says the best ways to get more diversity is to create more opportunities for public television news operations.
There's so little really serious journalism being done in the system that that's kind of the primary objective, is to, first of all, I think we have to create the engine of production, the kinds of programs that will hire people and build newsrooms.
To watch the entire panel discussion, go to freepress.net/summit.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Greetings. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here on WILL AM 580. Our guest today is Janine Jackson, the Program Director for Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, and also the co-host of Counterspin, heard right here on WILL AM 580. Joining us for a recorded program, going on, which you did slightly before going on air, so please don't call in today. Janine, welcome to Media Matters.
It's a pleasure to be here, Bob.
Well, you are one of our most popular guests, and we've had you on several times, and the phone lines always fill up because people are always eager to hear FAIR's assessment and your assessment of press coverage of the issues of the day. So today I thought I'd be selfish and hog you for myself so I could ask you all the questions I've always had. And before we go into the work FAIR does, which is critical analysis of news media and journalism, let's talk a little bit more about FAIR. Some of our listeners might not even be familiar with the group. You know, it's funny to think of it. It's almost a quarter of a century old now. Could you just give a little background on Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, please?
Oh, sure, absolutely. FAIR got started in 1986 with just a few people and a card table and a phone, basically. But Jeff Cohen and Martin Lee and later Norman Solomon and other folks felt that there really needed to be a movement that engaged media in the same way that other big issues were engaged, like the environment, where you traced their political connections, where you talked about the influence of corporations. They really felt that mainstream media in particular were just crying out for that kind of sustained analysis. Now, this is in the mid-80s, and they were thinking particularly about miscoverage and incomplete coverage of U.S. involvement in Central America. You know, they were definitely progressive people who were talking about particular viewpoints that were missing from the media. But really, it was a desire to ask the same kinds of critical questions we ask of media institutions. So it started as a nonprofit and still is a nonprofit, but it's grown to include a magazine, which is now monthly, called Extra, and a radio show, Counterspin, which came on some years later, which it's my pleasure to co-host and produce, and, of course, a website, and now an Action Alert Network, which is kind of a network of folks who respond directly to media outlets, to coverage that we don't like or calling for coverage we'd like to see. So we are media critics, media watchdogs, but along the way we've become media producers ourselves and also participate in sort of promoting alternative points of view in that way.
And you are the program director. What does that mean?
Oh, that's an excellent question. I'll let you know when I figure it out. You know? FAIR is a tiny organization. We make it seem as though we're a large army, but in fact we really only have six full-time staffers, and we each wear many different hats. So calling me program director is really just a way of saying I do many other things in addition to the radio show, and those things might vary from week to week, as is the case with all of us at a small nonprofit.
Has FEAR's work changed very much over the last 24 years now, or is it pretty much doing the same stuff it's always done, sort of focused on staying true to its mission?
Well, I would say that in some ways the essence of the task is the same, because as aware as one might be, oh yes, corporations own the media. Oh yes, reporters are subject to the influence of many different forces. We can be aware of that, but you still don't know how that may affect coverage of any given issue. No one's an expert in everything, the environment and the economy and foreign policy, and all of that. And it helps very much to have particular stories unpacked for us and explained for us in a way that takes into account what distortions the media coverage might bring to bear. So that part of the job really is the same, and it's except that the content of it changes from day to day, but the series of questions that we bring to bear and the kinds of outside points of view that we ask to come in and explain things for us, that mission has stayed the same, although we have different outlets to be looking at. The field has been joined, and we now certainly do include blogs, both as targets, if you will, and also as sources of information. Cable television, we weren't looking at too much in 1986. That's become a big part of where the conversation goes on, and so we track that too. So, some things about the job have changed, and in some ways it hasn't changed at all.
If you look at the news media in general, if you were to generalize for someone who didn't know anything about it and unaware of FEAR and really didn't have much of a developed critique of news media, and they said, Janine Jackson, what are the two or three main problems with the news media? What are the biases, the issues that you see that are really undermining the quality of press? What would they be?
Well, the first thing that I think of really is commercial ownership and the commercial goals of media in this country, the dominantly commercial goals. And I say that as distinct from corporate ownership, which lends its own problems. But the very fact that we've decided that we're going to subsume news reporting under the kind of rubric of making money, that we're going to say that newspapers need to sell ads to make money and television needs to be sponsored by advertisers. Once we made that link, I know to whom I'm speaking, the history of it, much of it I learned from you, that this was a choice in a way to have our media be so commercially driven. I think that really is the core problem. Anytime you have someone making a decision about what to put in the newspaper or what to put on the air, and as they make that decision, they must think about whether the sponsor will like it. They must think about whether it will drive up or down the stock price of the owner. I think that's always going to be a problem. And even the fact that they have to think, well, am I going to get the maximum amount of people to look at this so that my advertiser will be pleased? I think as media consumers, particularly of news media, we want very much and even still expect to some degree there to be some kind of pure criteria about what is the news we need to know, what does the public have a right to know and need to know, and even what are the creative choices that our culture might be making, that artists and entertainers might be making. We want those choices to be made somehow free of money-making constraint, and that doesn't happen. And I think all of the other concerns that I have about the state of U.S. media right now really spring from that. The cowardice of journalists, I think, springs from that. The lowest common denominator, cheap sensationalism that we see and that we suffer from as a society springs from that. So, there are lots of other particulars I might go into, but that commercial ownership and that profit-driven nature of media, to me, is the core of the problem.
One of the issues that people often talk about, my students talk about, and callers this program talk about, is the obsession with what the cable television news channels in particular, but really all news media to a certain extent, with spin and with pointless prediction and sort of salacious material on news programs, as opposed to doing actual reporting on the affairs of the day. And this came to me a few weeks ago when the book Game Change was released to much fanfare in early January. And I don't know if you recall the exact thing, but the night it came out, I happened to turn on the cable TV news channels, and it was wall-to-wall discussing this book. And I think there's a lot of interesting material in the book, don't get me wrong, but there's also a lot of what can only be called gossip. And the shows on all the channels were going after, you know, John Elizabeth Edwards and Bill and Hillary Clinton, all sorts of stuff that, you know, really seemed like bizarre, but it got the sort of attention you would get if the United States was being invaded by Canada or something. It got roughly parallel coverage.
I really don't understand. I don't see any justification for that, you know, and I recently wrote a piece for Extra about infomercials, which is another whole, you know, argument to have, but it really made me think about how little of what is on television in particular even is what we would call content, you know, and then within that, the tiny little piece that is news content, and then when you think of what that tiny little amount of time relatively is devoted to, it really is hard for me to justify and to explain. And I think also something that you were also pointing to was the speed of it, not just the spin, but the need to talk about a book that many people haven't read yet, to talk about things, you know, the instant that they happen and get through them in that next, you know, 1 hour, 2 hour news cycle, however short it's become. I think that's actually corrosive to our deliberative processes, you know, to our ability as individuals to think logically. When you see a pundit, for example, make a claim on Monday, it's proven wrong on Tuesday, but then on Wednesday, you know, not only are we not revisiting how he got it wrong and what steps he took to get it wrong and how he's not going to do that in the future, we're pretending it's never happened, you know, and we're moving on as though the conversation still made sense. You know, it almost doesn't matter whether what one says today actually turns out to be true. And if it doesn't matter what people on the news are saying is true, then I think we're really pretty far gone.
Our guest today on Media Matters, Janine Jackson, the Program Director for Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, and also the producer and co-host of Counterspin, which can be heard right here on WILL AM 580. We pre-recorded this episode of Media Matters a couple of weeks before going on air, so please don't call in. Sit back, relax, and let us do the talking today. And, you know, Janine, one of the issues that you've written about and that FAIR has covered over the last several weeks is an ongoing issue you've covered for 24 years, which is the threat to professional safeguards and journalistic values by commercial pressures. And it seems that these pressures have grown dramatically, if anything, in the last several years as news organizations find their revenue base of advertising shrinking or disappearing and making them ever more desperate. And one of the striking developments has been at the Washington Post, which has always been, along perhaps with the New York Times, considered one of the two or maybe three leading and most august newsrooms in the United States, if not the world. Talk a little bit about what's taking place at the Washington Post and what people should know about.
Well, people may remember that not too long ago, the Washington Post was kind of busted for a series of meetings or salons, as they called them, that they were planning to have, in which they were essentially going to sell access to Washington Post journalists to whatever industry, and it was healthcare industry was one that they were talking about specifically, but whatever industry could pony up the tens of thousands of dollars to sponsor the event. Now, this was something that came out because their marketing department was selling it essentially. But then when journalistic groups and media critics heard about it and made a fuss about it, the Washington Post sort of said, oh, well, we never actually planned to do that anyway. Of course, that would be very wrong. although I've heard subsequently, and I haven't followed up on this story, but that the fellow whose idea that was, now that he's out of the Washington Post, is continuing more strongly with the idea that media outlets should, I believe the term is, monetize their journalists. But the latest thing that's happening at the Post that is leading some people to think that they really are too far down the slippery slope is that they appear to have basically given over space, not on the op-ed page, but in the news section, to this outfit called the Fiscal Times. And listeners may have heard something about this, but the Fiscal Times is described as a startup news organization. But what it actually is essentially another organization that serves as an arm for Pete Peterson. He being, of course, the billionaire investment banker who started the Concord Coalition and the Pete Peterson Foundation, and these are organizations that folks will have heard of for basically attacking Social Security and Medicare for the last 20 years, calling for the privatization of those entities. Well, the Fiscal Times is now a news service to represent those views of Pete Peterson, and his son, Michael Peterson, hired the staff. The new thing is, unfortunately, they've hired some fairly reputable journalists in this case, and that's kind of a sign of how bad things are in the journalism industry, but they've found some veteran journalists to come and write stories basically that represent the point of view of Pete Peterson, as one would think, from an organization that is funded and started by Pete Peterson. And these are, you know, deficit hawk views that say we have to cut spending because Social Security is going to die, and essentially, you know, perhaps Wall Street should take a look at using those funds. The problem is the Washington Post has ran this article that said that they were working in partnership with the Fiscal Times and that didn't properly identify who the Fiscal Times were, and that didn't make it clear to viewers that they had basically auctioned off a story in their news section. And economist Dean Baker likens it to, he says, if the National Rifle Association started up something they called the Firearms Gazette, you know, could they get a story in the Washington Post that didn't identify it as being from the NRA and that simply represented their views on firearms, would that be okay? So it's a real troubling development that seems to be driven by ideology. The Washington Post editorial page has long been a fan of the Social Security crisis storyline, but it also seems to be clearly economically driven as well. Whichever motivation it is, it's a very sad and depressing development that we think the paper still has a chance to reverse, and we hope they will.
And if people want to learn more about this, and again, we don't know where it's going to be exactly when we go on air in 2 weeks, if they go to the fair.org website, they can catch up on it?
Absolutely. Fair.org will catch you up on the story, including the response from the Washington Post ombudsman, which was in itself not very satisfying.
You know, one of the things that FAIR does, you mentioned it earlier, is it sends out alerts periodically if you're on their list, and I am on it. I think I've been on it from the beginning. And there are now, I think, 55,000 people who get these alerts whenever there's an issue that comes up. And usually it's when there's some sort of coverage that FAIR regards as flawed, and then you ask people to email the ombudsperson or an editor at whatever the news medium might be and suggest, you know, criticism and that, you know, something be done to correct the matter. And FAIR must do these, I'm guessing, 20, 30 times a year?
Well, we put out... we try to do one or two a week.
Oh, that often.
Try not to. Yeah, we don't want to overload.
I must be deleting
your
email.
Yeah. We know people have a lot of other things to think about, and sometimes, you know, they start coming fast and furious when things go that way. But what I think is good about them is we try to keep them short, give you the information that you need, give you the links to the stories and the source material so folks can look it up themselves, and then we don't provide form letters. We really do give people a chance to put things into their own words. And very often, Bob, you know, we ask to get CC'd, to get copied on the letters that people do send. Very often people expand tremendously on the points that FAIR has made and really take the argument, to a new level and add new details to it that we didn't even know about. So they produce really some very smart letters to the editor and letters to producers, and we understand that they have an effect. You might not always see it immediately, but we know that, I'm not going to use the word thin-skinned, but we know that many journalists do look in their inbox. They do care what readers are saying about them, and we have on some occasions seen actual changes in reporting, which of course is gratifying. But a large part of what we're trying to do is to remind both the reporters and ourselves as citizens that journalism should be a two-way street, that you do have a right to talk back to the media when you feel they've done something wrong or when you feel they're not doing enough of something right.
You talked about the core problem, Janine Jackson, of American journalism being it's based largely upon sort of commercial values, so that making money is the dominant value, and journalism values sometimes get sacrificed as a result of that, especially in current times where the times are so hard for news media. The solution to that problem in many countries historically has been public broadcasting. In fact, almost all industrial countries have very large investments in public media compared to the United States. The United States public broadcasting is relatively weak, as everyone knows who's studied the matter, and as you well know. How would you judge the quality of journalism on NPR and PBS as compared to the commercial news media?
Well, you know, when I first came to FAIR in way back in 1992 or so, there was a much more, in some ways, vital debate going around PBS because it was during the era in which it was constantly being threatened to be defunded, and which the main accusation seemed to be, as then-Senator Bob Dole put it, that PBS was hiding behind Big Bird while they shoveled out funding for gay and lesbian programming. That's the sort of quote you don't easily forget, you know. And at that time, it used to be much easier to make an argument that while public media, public television and radio had far from lived up to their potential, the ideal of those entities when they started out. But that still, it was the place where if you'd heard something critical, if you'd seen something that was really challenging, that had a critical view on U.S. history, for example, chances were you saw it on public television. While I think that is still true today, I think it's really less true today. I think now the omissions, what PBS and what NPR are not doing, is much more glaringly obvious to us than it was even just 20 years ago or 10 years ago. Now one is always reminded, as, for example, PBS says that while they're not going to be distributing this show, many public television stations around the country are now going to be airing a new show that will be brought to you by the George W. Bush Institute. You know, this is what public broadcasting is going to bring us, while, meanwhile, Bill Moyer's Journal and Now are leaving the air, you know. So it seems to me in 2010 really incredibly clear that public broadcasting has really failed largely, wholly, to live up to those beautiful goals that were written into the Act back in 1967 about being a forum for controversy and debate and for being a space for voices that would otherwise be unheard. You know, as you know, when you talk about PBS, people can't really tell you what it's supposed to be about. It seems they think masterpiece theater. You know, they think it's supposed to be quality programming. But it really was supposed to be alternative programming, an alternative to commercial broadcasting, and to be a space where views that would not find a corporate sponsor could be heard. And I don't think anybody in this day and age would say that that's what we're getting from public broadcasting.
Our guest today in Media Matters, Janine Jackson, the program director at Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, also known as FAIR. You can find out about FAIR on the internet at fair.org. And you can subscribe to their magazine or look at it extra, which has been coming out now for almost two decades. And listen to Janine Jackson's program, which FAIR produces, called Counterspin, which is heard right here on WILL AM 580. We recorded today's show before we went on air, so please don't call in. Sit back, relax and let us do the talking. One of the other big developments in the last 5 or 6 years, Janine, has been the emergence of MSNBC as the putative liberal cable TV channel, specifically around three programs, The Ed Schultz Show, The Ed Show, and probably more prominently, Countdown with Keith Olbermann and The Rachel Maddow Show. Were you surprised to see these shows come on a station owned by General Electric? And how do they change your calculations of sort of commercialism in media?
Well, I don't think they. I mean, I'm pleased by the development of those things. I mean, you're happy for any little breath of anything that seems different, and those shows do seem different. Although I would, of course, have to point out that they're not exactly extremely radical. I mean, to take the sort of democratic position is a counterweight to largely what we see in certainly cable television, and I appreciate that, to be even a liberal, if not a, you know, full-on radical or progressive, that does add something new to the debate. To be someone who can say the word union without spitting, I mean, let's face it, that's a step up for what we got in news debate, and particularly on cable. So I'm not going to put them down for that reason. But, you know, I mean, Rachel Maddow describes herself as a national security liberal. I remember that when she came on, and I'm not really sure what that means. Olbermann is not famous for, you know, bringing people on and really grilling them and asking tough questions of politicians or of journalists. So, you know, I don't think it doesn't mean that all of a sudden we have what I think the political media debate landscape would look like if we really allowed everyone in and if we really removed those commercial concerns. It doesn't look like, for example, Grit TV, the show produced by my old co-host Laura Flanders, you know, which looks at topics of the day in a truly progressive, what I would say a truly progressive point of view that includes people that you haven't heard from before, you know, that you haven't read a million times, but that, my gosh, this person has something vital and interesting to say, you know, really new voices, bringing new voices and new perspectives into the conversation. So positive development, absolutely. I'm not going to kick it in the shins, but in no way does it say that, you know, now all bets are off and you really can't complain that we have a narrow debate. I think it just pushes the debate a little bit wider than it's been before.
Janine Jackson, you know, I do watch a bit of cable television news to pass time periodically in Dial Spin. And one of the striking phenomena to me is that if you go to Fox News, which is commonly regarded as a fairly conservative pro-Republican Party channel, they don't spend a great deal of time talking about what MSNBC and CNN are doing. They aren't criticizing Anderson Cooper or Ed Schultz. But when you go to MSNBC, and specifically Olbermann and Maddow, a significant percentage of their time is sort of, you know, criticizing and lampooning Fox News. What does it say that, you know, the right wing, even out of power, seems to be wagging, you know, holding onto the tail and sort of dominating the news cycle?
Well, I think, you know, you're actually making a point that I think is actually a critical sign that those shows don't go far enough and are sort of late in the game and don't do what I'm never one of those who wants to take a page from the right wing book, but I think there are things to be, because I don't like their book, you know, but there, I think there are things to be learned. And one of them is, rather than spend all your time calling attention to the points of view of people who disagree with you, you have to devote energy to promoting a counter-narrative. And that's exactly what I think those shows too often fail to do. And what used to be a criticism of so-called alternative media in general, the very name alternative media, you were still defining yourself in terms of what you were not, you know, and we get calls practically every week saying, stop using the term mainstream media because, you know, that actually legitimizes them in a way that we don't accept, and, you know, we actually have our own mainstream going on, which is not that. And those arguments gain traction with me every week because I do think the time has come and it's happening for independent media to do something other than filling in the gaps or correcting the distortions of what are the dominant media. That needs to be done. I mean, I'm a media critic, and that's what I do largely. But we have to be, as progressives, we have to be also promoting a different vision, promoting a counter-narrative that is not constantly referring back to what the other guys are doing. I think that's actually essential to building a movement and even to making good television and interesting television. And, you know, Grit TV is one example. Democracy Now! Would be another example. We could list those all day of independent media that really are doing that. They're really having a whole different conversation, which is very informative and can be very exciting when you don't get to see it.
Our guest, Deneen Jackson from Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. This is Bob McChesney. You're listening to Media Matters on WILL AM 580. Again, a pre-recorded show, so please don't call in today. Sit back, relax, and let us do the talking. Deneen, when FAIR started, the dominant sort of understanding, I think, in the United States, sort of the alternative to the mainstream media was sort of the critique that the mainstream media was liberal. And this is something FAIR wrestled with throughout its history. I think it's less, well, I don't know if it's less of an issue today. But the argument of conservatives has been that the mainstream, so-called mainstream media, was harder on conservatives and harder on Republicans than they were on liberals and on Democrats. And this bias really hurt conservative politics. And if I may make this statement, you can correct me if I'm wrong, much of the work of FAIR has been to expose that as not really empirically based, and instead to say the bias works very much the other way. Is that a FAIR assessment, and where does that stand today?
Well, it continues to be a FAIR assessment, and when they speak honestly, you can find Republicans and conservatives who will acknowledge that it's always been a FAIR assessment. We always remember the quote from Rich Bond, who used to be the chair years ago of the Republican National Committee, who described it as working the ref. You know, it's specifically a conservative strategy to beat up on media, to push them to the right, to say they never can go far enough to the right, they never can go far enough, and even when they do, you know, it's not far enough. And you do that in order to get the kind of coverage that you would like to see. The right wing made media criticism part of its strategy long, long ago. And there are also, of course, echoes of the McCarthy era, you know, that are very much alive among institutional journalism today, where journalists just kind of look over their shoulder for charges of communism or of left-wing bias more often than they do for any other sort of bias. But yes, FAIR has, in a number of ways and a number of different instances, explained and demonstrated that there is not, in fact, a liberal bias, that people often mean by that actually libertine bias. You know, many things they think of as sensational, you know, they associate with liberalism. But when you actually look at programs that promote a point of view or that discuss politics, what we find time and time again is that actually corporate power and official power are very well represented. And if you have to be partisan about it, it tends to be Republican over Democrat. But the point is, it's people in power as opposed to people out of power. And it's always been a whole range of public interest constituencies, whether it's labor groups or civil rights groups or gay and lesbian groups, have always been systematically underrepresented in our news programs and in our analysis programs. We've shown that time and time again. A huge study about national network television that we did a few years ago looked at a year's worth of coverage and found not just the over-representation of white men and Republicans over Democrats, but also time and time again those corporate voices, those official voices. And it really winds up being a kind of overdog bias that shows up most clearly in economic stories, but in other stories as well. So I think part of what people may mean, and it's true, is that if you look at the editorial positions of most media outlets, mainstream media outlets, you will find them to be socially liberal on a couple of social issues, reproductive rights, environmental issues, and often gay and lesbian rights. You will find editorial boards across the country taking what would be considered a liberal point of view on those issues. That's absolutely true. However, the conservative bent that they take on economic issues is such as to always completely, in my experience, drown out whatever sort of liberal social goals they might have. For example, in education, the New York Times will editorialize very strongly and beating their breast about how every child in every ghetto school deserves a chance. But then, at the same time, they more emphatically, and not just on the editorial page but in their news stories, are all gung-ho for vouchers and for charter schools and for the very sorts of union-undermining programs that many people who advocate for those poor children say are not the way to go. So you may hear papers espouse what people think of as liberal values. It's my experience, and I've written about it, that the demonstrable conservative and pro-corporate bias that they show in their economic coverage really is such as to completely counterweigh whatever liberal slant they may show on other issues.
Janine Jackson, I think that's a good segue to the final portion of the show, where I'd like to talk about the press coverage of a number of major political issues of the past year and get your take on the nature and quality of the coverage. And I think the best place to start is with the issue you just left off on, which is the economy, the economic crisis. How good of a job have our news media done keeping us abreast of the situation and giving citizens the understanding of what's actually going on?
Oh, I think it's been absolutely rotten. You know, as just looking at the sources, I think, tells you very simply what's going on. The very fact that it, and a number of people have said it, it's still true, the very fact that the very same people who claim not only did they not see a bubble coming in housing or in the stock market for that, but that when we go back to their statements of the time, folks like Greenspan, we show that they didn't think there was a bubble happening. They didn't think anything needed to be done. And yet, news media have simply anointed these people the experts, and so we're going to have stories including them, and if they're not actually speaking in them, shaped by them and their perspective, no matter what. So it's really, how could we be getting good coverage when journalists are still talking to the very same people who got it so wrong and still sort of poo-pooing the very sources who actually got it right? You know, I mean, we do see folks like economist Dean Baker seems to show up in the news media, I think, more often, having been one of the people who was very loud very early about the bubble. But, you know, that's not a big enough change. We really needed a whole reworking of the way that coverage was done, in the same way that we were going to suddenly be talking about institutional racism in the wake of Katrina. You know, the disaster is certainly big enough to warrant a new way of doing things, and journalists are still doing things in the same old way. And I think we're now going to have a kind of series of surprise stories. Surprise, African Americans are really struggling to recover this. Who would have known that they would suffer more than other groups? You know, that will be another thing that nobody anticipated and nobody knew, except that people know. They're just not in the news.
Going back to the economy for a second, Janine, what is the responsibility of journalists, of the news media, for the extent of the economic crisis we have? I mean, how much responsibility do they bear for the unraveling of our financial system?
Well, I think to the degree that they are responsible for informing the public, they do bear a tremendous amount of responsibility. I think it's not that the journalists were themselves expected to be experts, but what they should have been expected to do would be to keep an eye on the experts, to call for accountability from people, to track whether officials had their predictions had borne out. And simply doing that minimal work would have shown them that something was afoot. There also were numerous whistleblowers. You know, there are plenty of people who have now come forward in the Madoff case, for example, and in other instances, and have said, you know, I wrote to journalists, I wrote to people, I said this is fishy, there's something wrong here. So it was a matter of gatekeeping also on that front, which I think really kept perspectives out of the public conversation that, while it's unclear and we can't go backwards and guess that they would have completely been effective in shifting policy, they would have shifted public debate simply by being in it. So to that extent, for curtailing the public conversation, I think journalists bear a tremendous responsibility for the crisis.
Let's turn now to what was the most covered political issue probably of 2009 and going into early 2010, the health care debate. What's your assessment of how the news media did in covering that issue for the benefit of Americans?
Well, that's another disaster story, I have to say. That seemed to me a real clear example of media being not just not encouraging an inclusive debate and conversation, but actually sort of standing in the way of one. Because here you had a case, and listeners will know this, where there was majority support among the public for at least including at first something that would look like a single-payer plan or a single-insurer plan or Medicare for All, whatever you want to call it, but something that would look at state insurance provision for the people of the country and that would lower health care costs the way it's done in a number of other countries. The fact that a point of view could have majority support among the public and that same point of view not be able to get arrested in the corporate news media, I think tells you everything you need to know about the disconnect and about why people are so frustrated with media today. And then and I wrote a piece about this that was really about the way journalists use the public interest, having ignored what the public were saying they actually wanted, not even polling them about it or including that question in polls that were done, then journalists wanted to turn around and make up stories like, oh, there's increasing or decreasing support for the public option or for whatever particular provision was on the table that day. They would cite polls that would say that people seem to want the public option or want a little of it or more of it or something like that, as though they actually gave a hoot about what the public actually wanted, which was to at least talk about single payer. So I think that was a major, not just, I don't even want to say a journalistic failure, because it was so disastrous that one almost thinks they were succeeding at what they were trying to do, which was to narrow the conversation around health care reform to just the corporate friendliest possibilities.
One of the things in the healthcare debate, Janine Jackson, that I thought was very interesting was the news media tended to frame those conservative Democrats in the party who opposed a public option, not to mention single-payer health insurance. They framed them as sort of really appealing to, having to appeal to the conservative Democrats and the centrist in their states. And I was wondering, when you looked at the actual policies, what exactly was centrist about this bill as opposed to whatever, you know, Sherrod Brown had been proposing or Dennis Kucinich, in the sense that were more conservative Americans wanting to give bigger breaks to insurance companies? I mean, I didn't understand the use of the terminology.
I couldn't follow it either. It seems that moving to the right always means being centrist, and then that's always a good thing. You know, that seems to be corporate media's constant advice to Democrats in particular, is that the way to success, it's always presented as kind of dry-eyed political advice and not ideological, but simply what you need to do is to reach across the aisle and appeal to the most conservative aspects of not just the Democratic Party, but also to Republicans. But, you know, I'm not an historian, but I just don't think that's ever been the way to victory for the Democrats or for any party. You know, is to begin by conceding, you know, and start out not really being for anything. It's very depressing, and you make it actually almost too opaque to understand when you label that sort of thing centrist. I do think that's why a lot of people have really a difficult time following that kind of beltway coverage of issues, because it really doesn't, it does, the words don't mean what they seem to mean.
And now let's turn, Janine Jackson, to another big issue, and one that FAIR has been covering closely at its website and in Extra, which is the coverage of the surge in Afghanistan and Obama's policy in Afghanistan. You know, again, what's your assessment of the press coverage of the Afghan war in general and of the recent Obama administration surge in particular?
Well, I am struck just recently, and we talked about this on Counterspin on the radio show this past week. It's really, frankly, amazing to me that, and I would think as a journalism student, you would be really dismayed to see journalists who essentially were lied to and played for fools in the Iraq War and in the run-up to the Iraq War and sort of admitted as much, you know, in the wake of it, that they didn't ask enough questions, that they didn't challenge officials enough. And to see those same journalists essentially rehearsing those same steps in the Afghanistan war, and there's lots of examples of it, but I'm thinking about the New York Times just recently and their coverage around after Christmas, the turn of the new year, about this recent attack in eastern Afghanistan in which NATO claimed that they killed, the 10 people that they killed were all militants, were all Taliban, and immediately Afghans said actually they were civilians, and in this case they said many of them were children. But what was so striking to me was the way the New York Times and all the papers that follow in that same mode, in those initial stories, they simply took the Pentagon at their word. This is who they actually killed. The people they killed are exactly who they said they were. And they even kind of inoculated readers, you know, that Afghan people might be saying something different because it's a very contentious issue for them, you know, so look out for that. I mean, it seemed to me just the purest propaganda one could imagine, and it almost goes without saying that the official that they were quoting was anonymous and was not asked to give his name, and therefore was allowed to make all kinds of adamant assertions and not ever have them be traced to him or be accountable for them. It just seemed to me something that really could have come out of, you know, the worst Soviet reporting that people would make fun of, especially because in the instance of Afghanistan in particular, the Pentagon and these official sources have a track record of declaring adamantly that no civilians were killed in a particular attack, and then, as they did in this case in Kunar province, a few days later saying, well, they're not sure. That was the intelligence they had. And then when it is proved, as it has been in several cases, that there were civilians killed, then they say, oh, well, yes, in fact, there were civilians killed, but, you know, we try to avoid that. It doesn't matter how many times it happens. The New York Times and other journalists never add any challenge to those initial stories. They never allow them to come from behind, or rarely from behind, that cloak of anonymity. They still allow them to use that. And they act as though they've never been lied to before, or the Pentagon has never misled them before. And I find it almost kind of Alice through the looking glass, in a way. I don't understand how you can ever get independent reporting of a war if the Pentagon and the state can tell you what things that turn out to be untrue time and time and time again, and there's absolutely no learning curve. I don't know how you can do independent reporting if that's going to be your approach.
The spy who was a doctor, the double agent or whatever he was, who blew up several CIA agents, it comes out that he was most affected by the occupation of Gaza by Israel in 2009, where he had served as a doctor, and that sort of drove him to his political passions that he had. And Fair has written about this a great deal over the years, but the entire issue of Israel and Palestine, which sort of is a key factor, not the only one by any stretch, but a key factor in all the political machinations in the Islamic world. How is that issue covered in the United States by our news media today? Has it changed over the years for the better or for the worse? And how does our coverage compare to other democratic nations?
Well, I don't know about change over the years. What I would say is that, and Gaza is a good example, the sort of fealty to whatever, in this case, U.S. policy is, which has to be very connected to Israel. I'm not sure what would happen if the relationship between U.S. and Israel was changed fundamentally. I can't really tell if the corporate media are just going along with it because of an actual pro-Israeli bias, or if they simply go along with the United States official definition of who our enemies are and who our friends are. Whichever it goes by, the bias in coverage of Israel-Palestine that makes Palestinian lives seem to be worth so much less, and that is so slanted in coverage of settlements, for example, in which just recently, I mean, I'm not just singling out the Times, but it was the Times who've been running stories referring to neighborhoods, when in fact these are illegal settlements in Gaza, illegal settlements that are described all around the world as illegal, except for in the U.S. media. And what's interesting to me is talking about comparison to the debate in other countries, it often is made clear to us that the political debate in the Israeli media is much more open and vital and lively. It's much more possible to see something that is truly critical of Israeli policy in Gaza, for example, in a paper like Haaretz than it is in the New York Times. Many Israelis apparently feel that their country can be criticized like any other country. That doesn't seem to be the case. It really is something that you can call a taboo in U.S. media, which you can, looking at the reports of the Goldstone report on what happened in Gaza early in January of last year is a
actually,
perfect example.
Take a second and explain what the Goldstone report was, because I think most Americans have no idea what it is.
Well, it was, and I'm not going to give a very good accounting of it either, because I'm not an expert, but it simply was a report from, I guess, the UN, officially, of an accounting of what of Operation Cast Lead, that was the Israeli incursion into Gaza in January of 2009. And it simply, it called to account Palestinians and people who had been violent and had caused deaths, but it also looked at the Israeli army policies and the violence and the use and the civilian casualties incurred by them, and simply said that there had been crimes on both sides. And the very fact of having called Israel to account and said that they had committed crimes in Gaza brought this under denunciation in the U.S. Congress, in which people were encouraged to simply ignore it. And Goldstone, who of course is a venerable diplomat with many years' experience, was vilified as simply being biased and not knowing what was going on. And it really was just essentially an accounting, you know, an investigative report of what had gone on. Now, why don't we have a better accounting? Well, because journalists, if people will remember, Israel blocked journalists from being in Gaza to see and to report on what was actually going on, which in itself is a violation that should have raised questions. But no, if you're looking for really even-handed coverage of the Israel-Palestinian conflict, the mainstream media is in the United States is not the place to look. In fact, you'd be better off looking at the Israeli press.
Janine Jackson, we've only got a minute and a half left. So perhaps to end on sort of a more positive note, but what are some media that you would recommend, and I suspect it'll be mostly online, but not necessarily, that people use who are interested in getting a broader perspective, a different perspective than that they get through the daily newspaper or their mainstream news media?
Well, I would certainly recommend those aggregate news sites, those places like Common Dreams and Alternet that put a bunch of stories together for you, not just because you might be interested in the particular stories, but it might put you onto some whole new outlets that you then can follow on their own. I had cited Grit TV with Laura Flanders, which is also online, Democracy Now!, Grist. I've just been doing a lot of looking into environmental and stories about global warming. Grist Online is a wonderful environmental site. You can look at Counterpunch, Alexander Coburn's. That's going to have political stories you won't see other places. Electronic Intifada on Israel-Palestine is very interesting. And on economic coverage, I always check out Beat the Press, which is Dean Baker's look at the way mainstream media are covering the economy. And you can find that on the American Prospects website. And that's also very interesting.
And Dean, I should add, Dean Baker will be a guest on our program in the next few weeks, so stay tuned for that. Lastly, Janine Jackson, there's like one huge story you think that our news media is missing. Not that it's covering it poorly, it's just not covering it at all. If there's one thing you could say, this should be covered, what would it be? Oh, you can give two. If you
I think we've got to go back to prisons. I think that story's been dropped, and I think there are human rights violations. There's an economic story. There's all kinds of stories about how we're choosing to treat people and spend money in our society that we've kind of dropped. The civil justice system and the prison system need to be looked into, absolutely. And the differing impacts of this economic crisis, not just the big story, but the myriad smaller stories that are all going to be different and that are all going to shine a different kind of light on the way the economy works for people. Those are important stories, and I think they're great stories for reporters to follow.
Our guest today in Media Matters, Janine Jackson, the Program Director at Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. You can find out about FAIR at FAIR.org and all the myriad work they do. She's also the co-host of Counterspin, which can be heard right here in WILL AM 580. Janine Jackson, thank you for taking time out of your day to join us today.
It's been a pleasure.
I'm Bob McChesney. You've been listening to Media Matters. I'll be back in 167 hours. Everyone have a great week.
You've been listening to a rebroadcast of a Media Matters program that originally aired on January 31st.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance, private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events, lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
In the weather forecast for Champaign-Urbana, mostly sunny skies this afternoon with a high around 89 degrees. Tonight, clear skies with a low of 68. Monday will be mostly sunny, and there's a chance of scattered showers and thunderstorms in the afternoon, the high around 88 degrees. And Monday night, mostly clear with a low of 67. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL, 580 AM and 90.9 FM, HD2 and HD3 Urbana.